Welcome to Bombshell. I'm Erin Simpson.
I'm Lauren Deanne Shulman.
And I'm Radha Iyengar.
And we are back with a differently distributed episode. Obviously, we've been distributed for many weeks now. We were distributed many weeks last year as well. But this time, this week, we are in new locations. I am recording from my sister's attic, which I have to say is, in fact, quite lovely. Lauren, you're recording from your soon-to-be former office.
That's right. I am packing my office while we record, so I will offer pithy insights while wondering why I have so many Tom Ricks books. Nothing against Tom Ricks, but I'm not going to read these books again, and I've been carting them from office to office for a decade. 15 years.
Oh my God, is Fiasco 15 years old?
Yep.
Holy crap, it is. Oh, no. I can't deal with that insight this morning. And Radha is in her usual undisclosed location in the Bay Area where she hunkers down and avoids small children and large children.
That's right. I was like, I'm hiding in our creepy room. That's what we used to call it before it became my permanent work office. It smells great, guys. Don't worry about it.
Exactly. There's definitely some Pinterest posts and other things to be done in the next God knows how many months about just how many weird home spaces have been converted and with what measures, you know, how much Febreze, how much, you know, of those like odor absorbing gel bobble thingies, you know, you've had to put in places to make it work. So thank you all our listeners for bearing with us.
So I am personally like continuously intrigued by the war that is going on between Claire McCaskill and the Slate dude, and then the Republican advisor dude, whose names I'm clearly remembering, Steve and John, in terms of their rape my room background.
Oh my God.
Yeah, they're doing a fundraiser on this now. They're raising money for personal protective equipment to be sent to, first it was the Navajo Nation, and then it was various other Native American communities. So you can buy a Team Claire, Team John, or Team Steve shirt, and they're displaying it, but all the while upping their own game in terms of having pineapples and cakes and pianos and all kinds of flower arrangements in the background of their TV appearances. I love it.
That's extraordinary. I barely get dressed for things and my company does not really use video, thank God. So I continue to agree that video is definitely a security violation and we should definitely not include it in any of our future meetings so that I can continue to, you know, not have to appear like a professional human. Any hoodle, ladies, what are we drinking this morning? This is a Sunday. Does any of us have anything fun or are we a little bit functional today?
I'm drinking what may be my last or probably last series, depending on how long I'm here today, cups of institutional coffee from one of those machines that you press the buttons and it gives you either a cappuccino or a vanilla latte or something else. And yet they all kind of taste the same.
Mm-hmm. I'm drinking coffee in the coffee machine that I put in the back of my car and drove to my sister's house. So, you know, never leave home without it. And I've almost taught my nieces how to make coffee, which would really be, I mean, that's like squad goals for the next however long that I'm here. So just some regular coffee, living the dream.
Yeah, I too am drinking coffee from I have for many years used a French press and recently we decided to get a fancy new pour over thing, which is a little fussy, but does produce some delicious tasting coffee. So there you have it.
Oh, outstanding. So in terms of an agenda today, basically this is the Jan Brady episode of China, China, China. And we have a variety of China topics. And then we will talk about some of the current goings on in the United States before ducking into pop culture. But we're not going to have kind of we could artificially break these down into keeping up foreign relations and White House or American mayhem. But I think we will just start with a story that I basically totally missed last week. So I'm excited to have Radha and or Lauren help me understand this, which is some new developments with Huawei and also the United Kingdom and also China things. So one of you ladies, please enlighten me.
Well, why don't I start with the trade part and then maybe Lauren can chime in with some of the developments on the foreign agreement side, or foreign planning side. So the TLDR here is that the U.S. issued a new rule that bans chip makers from using U.S. machines and software in the manufacturing of semiconductors that are used for 5G. So the key here is Huawei had a planned expansion of 5G. You may recall, listeners may recall from previous episodes, our talk on the national security risk of that, given the potential turnover of information to the Chinese government. The thing is that even for even in places like China, where they've worked really hard to reduce foreign dependency on inputs, almost all the companies rely on U.S. software. And there are a couple of specific software brands that are used in this semiconductor design and production. So what the U.S. did was essentially make it nearly impossible for 5G expansion to go on according to plan. Now, on the one hand, this is a pretty effective move at making it hard for Huawei to continue as is, but it does essentially weaponize U.S. dominance in this semiconductor design space and creates a clear indicator to the world that that means that you are dependent on the U.S. in the context of other national security and intelligence related issues, which can be potentially risky given what we've talked about in the past on sort of U.S. lack of predictability.
That sounds fun.
So the other half of the Huawei 5G story this week, which is going to be we're studying in the coming months, is that the UK announced that they would like to pursue an alliance of 10 democracies to create an alternative pool of 5G equipment and technologies to avoid reliance on Huawei, which is meant to include, in theory, all the G7 countries, as well as India, Australia, and South Korea. This is after, I think we talked about this a couple of months ago, the UK had said that they would allow that Huawei to build or be a part of some of its 5G infrastructure. It got a lot of pushback from that and then started, including from within the Conservative Party, and ended up not exactly reversing course, but trying to come up with an alternative means of eventually phasing Huawei out of that 5G infrastructure. The challenge with this is like there's not like a great solution that is an alternative. Ericsson, Nokia, Samsung, like none of them are at a level where they can easily compete with Huawei at this time, which is why it's going to create some serious industrial policy to generate an alternative amongst the existing companies, or maybe coming up with some sort of open architecture alternative that is sort of none of the above, or maybe a combination of the above. But again, this is right now is just like an on paper idea, but was a really good sign in terms of European interest in seeking an alternative and European pushback against the pretty significant lobbying that China and Huawei have done over the past couple of months, not only on the matter of 5G, but they've been a serious soft power player in trying to, you know, put Huawei labels on PPE bits being donated, having them be a big part of saying, you know, China is not the bad guy right now. This is a good pushback in that space to the Chinese dominance of that field.
And so that's also interesting from kind of a Five Eyes perspective, right? So you have UK is obviously a really important mm-hmm. intelligence partner, especially for signals intelligence with the United States. That alliance would also include Australia, Canada, also part of the G7, but maybe leaves out New Zealand, which is interesting. But it's a, you know, from the perspective that I've sort of been watching this, you know, over the last few months, does seem to be definitely a better trajectory. Whether they can pull it off remains, you know, very interesting. And as Radha, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but as best I understand, Ericsson and Nokia and Samsung basically can compete in terms of actual underlying technology. Where they haven't been able to compete is on price. Huawei remains just significantly cheaper, possibly, oh, who could say, due to the fact that they are subsidized by their national governments.
Yep, that's exactly right. There's a clear national security risk from having Huawei be the dominant 5G provider. It remains to be seen how effective, how much these types of interventions really ratchet things up. But the UK development has the potential of, rather than using sort of market forces to constrain Huawei, using international agreements, which might be sort of more norm restoring than the current approaches.
It's a good point to remember that the concerns with Huawei are not just that it is Chinese led and CCP influenced, but also that there are serious concerns about how high quality the technology and software is, and whether or not there are serious security risks associated with it, not just because it, again, is Chinese, but because that they have poor quality controls in their development process. So the norm, restoring norms and restoring specific standards and principles to how countries are investing in their 5G architecture could be a good way of making this not just about no China, but also about having a quality and strong infrastructure to replace the 4G infrastructure that's going on right now.
Awesome. Well, that's definitely something we will be keeping an eye on, and I think remains part of this. You know, how do you do some sort of, you know, quote unquote major power competition in the face of completely integrated supply chains and, you know, kind of global infrastructure and industry, right? That's the piece that remains, you know, I don't see how the Cold War, quote unquote, provides us much guidance there, because there really wasn't a lot of economic integration between the Soviet Union and too many other folks. So definitely interesting to see international institutions piece, a norms piece, and then we'll see how the market piece, you know, plays along with that. So thank you, ladies, for flagging that for me this week. I learned a lot. Meanwhile, there's a pretty significant troop buildup on the China-India border. Folks may or may not be aware that China and India share a 2,000-mile-long land border. There's also been a number of dust-ups and, you know, minor wars along that border over the last 60 years or so. And this last couple of weeks, we've had reports that there are several thousand Chinese troops along the border between China and India, along the Indian province of Ladakh. So is this something that we should be super concerned about, Radha? Is this something that is kind of routine? What's your sense, or what's the reporting seem to be indicating here?
So I think there are a couple of things, and I should just clearly cite here that a bunch of my insights on this were drawn by just going through Tanvi Menon's Twitter feed and then clicking on all of the documents she recommended I read to learn about things. So, you know, apologies to Tanvi for not capturing all of her brilliance, and recommend, I'll include some of her tweets in our show notes. But I think there are a couple of different things to keep in mind here. So one, and just really important, this is a mountainous region in the Himalayas. This clash has happened sort of once before, once recently before, and many times before. But it's like a super weird geography. So it's like curvy mountain passes. It's very hard from the outside to get information or direct visibility on what's going on. So a lot of it relies on the military leadership on each side reporting back to their leadership, and those leaders then talking externally, which, as you might imagine, generates just a lot of game of telephone on this. And the second thing is, as I mentioned, like, this actually has happened a number of times before. So there are a number of like clear documents that demonstrate like where the border actually is based on agreements, as well as like crisis escalations mechanisms. All of that having been said, it's not great. India is sort of, China is very much projecting force along this border. Right now, India seems to be in de-escalation mode, which is sort of reassuring. But that having been said, it's not clear how long this is sustainable, especially given Modi tends to be much more sort of defensive of his country's borders and incidents like that, and is very willing to take much more escalatory stance. So I think the question here is like, how much of these military skirmishes and sort of pressed by China is really China just trying to take advantage of the current situation in India with still relatively high COVID infection rates and sort of hoping to press their advantage of that? And how much is this China pushing forward for key border areas as it relates to things like Tibet, which is where I think this border region comes into particular play? And so I think we'll see that play out over the next few weeks and months to give us a sense. And India's reaction will probably give us a good pressure test on that.
You know, taking a break from packing for a second, we have talked about before, but I'll just highlight for people again that this so plays into the Chinese strategy of trying to be incredibly influential in international organizations. China is not super great at a charm offensive, but they are really, really good at infiltrating bureaucracies with their own people and experts in a way that helps develop norms, standards, processes, investigations, and other areas that are in their favor. And the United States even though we created or instigated or led the development of so many of these international institutions in order to do exactly that, has effectively forgotten that premise over the last several decades, participates far less in the leadership, the bureaucracy, and other and the standards development process of so many of these institutions, and has ceded ground to China, usually just tacitly. In this case, in withdrawing from the World Health Organization, it's basically just being like, okay, we give up, we lost. China, you take over. Which, you know, I think there's a fair argument to be made about whether or not, like, there are some cases where that may actually be merited. But the World Health Organization is not just a proactive organization. It also is an information sharing organization where countries are supposed to be reporting, here's where we're having virus outbreaks, here's hotspots, here's successes that we've had in treating it. And to not be a part of that infrastructure, no matter how you feel about the organization itself, not only for coronavirus, but for other things, is really concerning. So Rada is exactly right to flag that we may not actually be withdrawing from World Health Organization and like the specifics really matter. But that is a specific that is definitely worth tracking, not just the leadership of it, but the ability to participate in all of these resources that are beneficial to the rest of the world, but also super beneficial to us.
Yeah, and a couple of pieces that I was reading as well, trying to get at some of the underlying dynamics of why this particular area and maybe why some of these dust ups. You know, we talked about this, I think, in year one of the podcast, actually, in a slightly different area, but along the same border. And that's partially, I think, a result of both China and India have kind of are extending infrastructure projects, you know, through this area, and in particular building roads. And so China has a Belt and Road Initiative that goes through the Pakistan-controlled portion of Kashmir and goes through to its port in Pakistan at Gwadar. That's definitely, allows for civilian infrastructure on the Pakistan side, but clearly facilitates a good amount of military infrastructure and movement for the Chinese. Similarly, the Indians have been building infrastructure in this part of Indian-controlled Kashmir, and you know that both allows for some greater economic integration, but also allows for potentially greater military mobilization or more quick military mobilization of Indian troops to this border with China. And so, in terms of kind of long-term or you know, underlying dynamics, it doesn't seem like we're going to be able to back fully away from this tension in the near term. But, you know, there are some, it does sort of seem to be a posturing thing, right? So of note, right, no actual shots have been fired. There are these, people may remember some of the videos from 2017 where there were like fist fights occurring at the border. It's literally, I mean, kind of an amazing throwback. But you know, this is not, you know, a place of active conflict, but definitely a place of high tensions. And Rada, you know, you highlighted the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi. You know, both he and the Chinese leadership are in kind of fairly nationalist moments, right? And so both sets of leaders have a lot of incentive potentially. I mean, they've been rallying kind of nationalist bases, despite one being a democracy and one being an authoritarian state, but also have potentially maybe have domestic crises that they're trying to direct some attention away from, right? So I don't want to say that it's necessarily a pure wag the dog situation, but there definitely are some other domestic circumstances that might drive these leaders both to stir things up here and that might keep them a little bit from being able to back down too easily. So that's the kind of domestic politics piece that I would keep an eye on there as well.
And just one more theme that I think will come up in a number of different settings is that I think a big risk in this area is that there's just a lot of disinformation and efforts to escalate the situation coming from a lot of different sources. And I think the difficulty in verifying information on the ground or the lag in that sort of makes the situation particularly ripe for that. So it is kind of important to keep a lot of the initial and especially sort of real time and unverified reporting. Take it with a grain of salt.
That will apply to all of our topics this week, including the next one, which is China's machinations in Hong Kong, which we haven't talked about here too recently. But there's been a pretty significant development in how the Chinese are proposing to manage or deal with Hong Kong. Last week, the National People's Congress, which is kind of a paper tiger of a legislature in China, but approved a national security law for Hong Kong, which criminalizes subversion and terrorism and all kinds of things that we typically think are bad, but are difficult to distinguish from, you know, freedom fighting and what we would call free speech. That law would also allow mainland state security services to operate freely in Hong Kong. And I think that that's one of the things that will certainly be caught most of attention. This has generated a fair amount of outcry, but obviously within Hong Kong, but also around the world. And an interesting note, you know, we've had a couple of moments here of U.S. Integrated international cooperation. The United States, Canada, Australia, and the U.K. issued a public statement sort of condemning the law and, you know, encouraging the Chinese to, you know, not to implement it or to move back away from it. So that's kind of puts us back essentially at square one where we were, I guess, maybe a year ago in Hong Kong when a similar law, not identical, but similar is what triggered significant protests, you know, over the course of 2019.
So Trump issued a pretty strong response to this himself on it. And it had a couple of different components that I think are interesting and probably worth thinking a little bit about. One relates to visas and travel. And some of this actually is, you know, rightly in light of the concern of increased surveillance and sort of lack of freedom of research and freedom of movement from people who would come from places like Hong Kong and who had previously enjoyed a more special relationship status. He also threatened sanctions on the Chinese and Hong Kong officials who he thinks have been involved in eroding the territory's autonomy. Now, I should note, it wasn't exactly clear what these sanctions would be and what form and how they would be applied. So I think there's a little bit of clarification to be done there. And notably, he did not pull back from phase one of the trade agreement, which folks might remember halted tariff hikes. So we still have the tariffs in place, but we're not going to continue ratcheting them up. It was a sort of interesting tactic, you know, different than Trump's more traditional ones in that it was very targeted on the security and Hong Kong related situation and not necessarily on the broader economic conditions.
Well, except for this one element of it, right, which is the question around Hong Kong's special trade status more generally.
Correct.
So as I was reading up on this, I was reminded that last year, the U.S. Congress passed the Hong Kong Human Rights Democratization Act or Democracy Act, which requires them to certify, requires Congress to certify each year that Hong Kong is indeed autonomous from China or has autonomy from China. And if they don't, then if they say that Hong Kong is in fact not autonomous, that opens the door to change Hong Kong's special status. And because, Radha, you probably knew this, but I certainly did not, but it makes a ton of sense, that the tariffs and other trade policies that we levy against mainland China do not apply to Hong Kong. They basically kept the carve out that they had when they were still a British colony or British territorial possession and continue to operate in a kind of quasi, you know, not a separate country, but the Chinese and the Americans have been content for them to have this sort of special status. And so one of the things,
two systems.
Right. And those two systems allow them to have free market trade with the rest of the world, which is great if you have a thing called, you know, HSBC. I guess Mike Pompeo is the one who suggested this week that they would revisit that and potentially revoke the special status that applies to Hong Kong. And that has sort of, you know, upended, you know, is a further escalation, you know, so while we're not talking about, you know, targeted sanctions or more broadly or increasing tariffs writ large, applying those, you know, Beijing sanctions to Hong Kong strikes me as pretty escalatory and would have, you know, pretty dramatic effect on the Hong Kong economy. And as best I can tell, kind of Hong Kong democracy activists are torn about whether that's would be a good thing or a bad thing, you know, whether it will actually force revisions or, you know, be a valid threat against mainland China or whether it was just all part of the terribleness that is Hong Kong in 2020.
Right. And I mean, like the complexity of Hong Kong is that its actual like trade custom zone. So like folks may remember this from our Brexit discussion, but Hong Kong actually does have a custom zone that's independent. It derives from some old GATT agreement that was basically institutionalized in the WTO. So it doesn't actually require Washington to recognize the autonomy of Hong Kong for other countries to recognize Hong Kong as a separate, like, sort of customs union and subject to different tariffs. But the United States is such a sort of critical partner in this and critical sort of recognizer for Hong Kong that pulling the U.S.-Hong Kong trading relationship in this context would just be a huge impact on the economy, especially when there's uncertainty then about if those tariffs apply to Hong Kong as they do to China and other countries trade with Hong Kong. How do we think about those intermediate tariffs being spread? So I think, you know, if that were, if we go down that route, it will have huge economic impacts probably on both Hong Kong and the global economy.
Okay.
So cheery.
Cheery. And as we segue slightly into, you know, a little bit more American related political topics, we also have a discussion of the World Health Organization and China and the World Health Organization and Trump and the World Health Organization. What's our deal here? I will admit, I saw this and I was like, I can't, it sounds bad, moving on. I did not give a great deal of attention to that this week.
Yeah, so it's a little confusing. Trump has said that he's going to withdraw from the WHO. And this comes from Trump having a pretty strong view that the WHO covered up on China's behalf the true extent of the coronavirus effects, the complexity of it. And generally, you know, to be clear, Trump has never particularly liked the WHO, but he's not entirely wrong. I think the WHO probably has some cleanup to do and probably wasn't as hard on China as it could be. This comes, of course, on the heels of Trump threatening to freeze funding, which he did, I think, last month or early in May, end of April, and sort of threatening a more comprehensive review. So that said, Trump threatened to withdraw. It's not totally clear he can do that. So WHO is not like a totally voluntary thing. It actually derives from a treaty. It's not totally clear if Trump can just quit or if that requires congressional approval. Actually, it's not clear generally whether U.S. withdrawal from treaties requires congressional approval. U.S. entrance into them does, but the withdrawal is sort of confusing. So
it feels like something we should get sorted out. I'm just, because we're withdrawing from a lot of them, actually. So we should, you know, anyway, continue.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess, you know, I think the TLDR here is it's clear that the U.S. is not going to be a leader in the WHO community under the Trump administration. So it's not going to lead the charge to fix or repair the WHO. And the question is, how much can the U.S. actually exit the WHO in a formal way? And how much of this is going to be just the U.S. not funding it and not being engaged or involved in it, which is not, neither of those are great, but one is more easily reversed or changed in the future than the other. All right. Well, so that's where we are. Erin, does that make you feel better?
I mean, not exactly, because I spent most of my week paying attention to all the arms control treaties that we were leaving, which we will get to in a future episode. So, you know, yeah, a little dicey. And also, things aren't going super great on the home front, as many of us have noticed. So we usually call this segment something like White House mayhem. I think it's maybe more accurate to call it American mayhem for the moment. But we want to take just a minute and kind of dissect the protests, the kind of police riots, a number of other, you know, outbreaks of violence that we're seeing across the country this weekend. And, you know, kind of reflect on that a bit, see what kinds of people, I mean, do we have some insightful thoughts? Can we make sense of this, ladies? Or is this just sort of Rome is burning?
So I want to separate a couple of different things that I think are happening, which are there have been and continue to be protests regarding police use of force and the continued use of violence targeted at the Black community by police officers in a number of cities, the most recent of which being a video of the murder of George Floyd. And so in that context, the vast majority of the protests and protesters are not violent and are protesting a really egregious continued violation of basic rights. And it's also worth noting that there's a long, long historical context of the use of force against the African-American community across the U.S. There's a tremendous amount of writing both by historical scholars and political scholars. And it's worth just sort of keeping that context in mind with some of the escalations that have been happening, which is the sort of second thing of escalations on both the side of protesters protesting the treatment of the Black community by police and the quote unquote counter protests slash, I don't even know what to call them, like sort of organized violence that seems to be, or disorganized violence that seems to be sort of being injected into the system. And the third is just a lot of incendiary rhetoric and questionable comments on who's involved in the protests, the underlying nature of the protests, and responses to the protests. And so I think the combination of those has just made it really, really bad.
Really bad, I think, is a good summary. I think there's also an element, you know, there's a lot of misinformation, you know, there's a lot of disinformation potentially in the system. For those of us who tend to get a lot of our news and reporting from Twitter, it's hard to kind of keep the micro and macro contexts, you know, in place. And so, you know, there are some things that, you know, on Twitter or on CNN, you know, look like an entire city is in flames, you know, instead it's like there's this one, you know, intersection where there is a confrontation and the rest of the city is fine, right? And so just trying to kind of keep, you know, that zooming in and zooming out, I think is a challenge that from an analytical perspective, I know that I always struggle with. You know, I actually got into political science and the, you know, study of insurgencies through the discussion of, you know, protest and repression, right? And kind of the dynamics around local protest movements, social movements, how social movements choose to employ strategies of nonviolence, when social movements choose to engage in violence. I think before on this podcast, we've talked about the book, The Rebel's Dilemma, which is really about how you solve collective action problems, you know, through, you know, protest or militant organizations. You know, the flip side of that is the state's dilemma, which is how do you, you know, make sure that the state is able to effectively call up troops when it needs to, but also that those troops employ violence according to a specific set of rules of engagements. And, you know, that's certainly something that we're seeing a lot of variation on at the moment. I would say that the state is definitely feeling a dilemma at the moment. They have not solved the state's dilemma in many of these locations right now. And we're seeing some of that in this discussion of National Guard versus police. That often leads to a discussion around militarization of the police, the difficulty in telling the guard troops apart from local police, especially SWAT teams, but also the difficulty, I mean, the differences in rules of engagement. And so you see folks, you know, people that we've, you know, spent time overseas with or served in government with, you know, talking about the rules of engagement that many of the local police forces, you know, appear to be following, at least in some instances, are things that would never have been permitted, certainly would have been against the rules of engagement in our deployments overseas. And, you know, that's, there's going to be, you know, enough anecdotes to support a number of different, you know, conclusions potentially on that. But I do think that it is the case that default training for police, you know, used to be that, you know, like use of force is the last resort. And I think that that's one of the things that we, it feels like has been eroding, but maybe I'm saying that as a white woman, you know, that may be true in my communities, but maybe use of force was always the first resort or a common resort in places that I was not prevalent. So, you know, there's a lot to be unpacked here and a lot of kind of social and economic questions that go along with specific tactics of protest, specific tactics of violence, both by protesters, but also by the state.
Yeah, Erin, that last point you brought up is such a great, it's a good reflection of like the kind of lenses that people are bringing to this, the larger narrative that is going on now and the microcosms of different stories. And there's a couple of things that have struck me in the last few days that are obvious points, but like, as you just watched national commentary, seem to get lost in the mix. And one is that there's been a pretty significant emphasis, as you point out, on acts of violence by police as against what appear to be innocent civilians, so obviously are innocent civilians, but also in particular press. And those are absolutely worth calling out and condemning. But I notice, particularly amongst the press, and I understand this, whenever it happens as against the press, there's an enormous outcry that is not in any way matched when you see the comparable acts of violence as against African-American men and women and kids that have been going on for years now. It's just a very different way that we look at the story of saying that the acts against the press are just a horrible milestone in the deterioration of democracy when those should have been the key indicator of a deterioration of democracy, that our own citizens are under attack by the police that are supposed to be there to protect them. I think a second interesting lens that is going on is that there is a tendency that when we start saying that there's foreign actors or outside influence that are trying to shape the narrative of these protests or trying to influence their behavior in some way, that people try to in some way lessen the grievance that was felt originally by people and when they started these protests. And I think that we've got to hedge against that, like that even though we may see, if we start to say that, you know, the Russians are involved or that white supremacists are involved, that those are bad and worth looking out for, but it should in no way take the spotlight and the attempt for justice and reconciliation off of the original underlying grievance that we saw there. And I guess the last piece that I would say on that is that it's remarkable kind of seeing people say that voting is one of the big solutions that we should be taking away from this. And like, mm-hmm. Yes, that's absolutely true. But look at the makeup of the city council, the mayor's office, the governor's office, and elsewhere in Minnesota. You might take away from those that this was a state that had it shut together, and you would be wrong in so many ways, given how they have responded, both on a day-to-day basis, but and more largely to this overall crisis. So I think voting is a good piece of this, but we shouldn't take that as like the only solution at this point that people will be satisfied with and should be looking for other steps from leaders in order to pursue addressing the rebel dilemma and the state dilemma, as you brought up earlier.
And just a couple of quick additions to what Lauren said. So I think first, at least for as much as we have data on this, which is not great, but does exist, I think we could easily go back at least about 30 years and document like systematic disproportionate violence against the Black community. It clearly goes on much longer than that. I think the difference now is the ability to document and demonstrate the nature of the one-sidedness of it. And I think that that has allowed a verification of claims that this community has been making for a long time that didn't previously exist. It's important to recognize that what we're seeing now is our ability to agree basically based on objectively viewing the situations, not necessarily even a difference in rates or levels of violence. But I think the second piece, and I think I was very much struck in the same way as Lauren about this voting conversation, which is in some ways the ability to safely move around is a precursor to any of these other political rights. And so to the extent that you care about voting and you want people to have voting access, to the extent that you care about any of the sort of like civic engagement strategies here, there needs to be sort of real accountability and real sort of meaningful evaluation of exactly as Aaron noted, rules of engagement and the ways in which police officers are allowed to engage in communities. And that goes both to the policies and actual rules, which many police departments have in terms of de-escalation, but also goes to the question of how much military equipment should be provided, how much should we be militarizing police forces, in what context is that gear allowed, as well as how do we think about the use of more militant forces in the context of these. And so in that, it's worth noting that the National Guard has been called out under state authorities in a number of areas to help support local police. Those state authorities are not the same as having the U.S. military under Title 10, the federal military authority, but that is also sort of on the table. And the threat of that sort of using the military to reduce the violence of a small amount of violence over a small number of days stands in pretty stark contrast to the lack of any real coordinated response to reduce the continued and sustained violence against the African-American community. And I think it's worth sort of reflecting on the difference in the intensity of those reactions.
So we'll include some, you know, related articles and pieces in the show notes. I will say that Christianity Today actually has this incredible piece about George Floyd and the work that he was doing in Houston, and you know that the real tragedy that his murder in Minneapolis does in fact represent one of many. I feel awkward here shifting to pop culture, which is usually where we bring a bit of levity to a conversation. I'm not sure that we deserve a great deal of levity, given what's going on at the moment, but maybe we can find a way to make that awkward transition and talk about some things that are we've been enjoying. I can start by saying that I've been watching a lot of shows that are popular with 11-year-olds, which, as many of you may know, is not my usual fare. But if you are looking for fun things to watch with not small children, but not yet teenagers, which I have to say is a difficult needle to thread. We've been watching Nailed It, which is extremely popular with this crowd. A little bit of Great British Bake Off. And a lot of Sophia the First, which is not for the 11-year-old, but for the 7-year-old. And among the Disney Junior properties, has the least problematic gender dynamics, despite everyone actually wearing bustles and corsets. So that's a low bar for Disney Junior, but here we are.
My house was very excited about the SpaceX launch, as you might imagine. We are married to someone who's into space stuff. It was a very exciting day. It was an exciting day regardless. And so we decided to celebrate that by watching Space Force. And
which is the new TV show with Steve Carell.
It sure is. But it also has like Lisa Kudrow is his wife. So I don't know if it would be great for everyone. But if you have ever worked in or around the Pentagon, really in any capacity, and have had some sort of engagements with the joint staff, it is a show for you. Clearly aimed at a target audience, but really nails those dynamics in a way that I would highly recommend as a sort of evening lightweight activity, especially if you're looking to give your brain a break from everything else that is going on.
So I just finished the Hunger Games prequel, which, if you have not been tracking, puts President Snow as a young man as the main character. And like, I need a book club on this. Like, it's good. It's really good.
How fast did you read it? Did you finish it in like 3 hours?
I bought it on Saturday morning and I finished it this morning. There were so many moments where I was caught up in viewing Snow as an incredibly sympathetic figure. Then like one word would catch me and I'd be like, wait a second. Is he a sympathetic figure? I'm not sure. It's a great portrait of what I would say is kind of elite grievance, or maybe almost populist, right-wing populist grievance, that gets you into a headspace that makes you, I guess, more understanding, not necessarily want to align, but certainly understanding of the path that is taken from where Snow starts as a child to an incredibly violent and authoritarian person. And then the education piece that he goes through, his role in early Hunger Games, his relationship with a young woman in District 12 of all places, which I'm not giving anything away, that starts at the beginning, are just really interesting background of where we ended up in the Capitol and Pan Am later on in the Hunger Games books. I came at it with a lot of questions. There's a lot of elements that I would love to see explore a little bit more. Some of it was a little superficial, but like, you just have to keep in mind, this is a kid's book. There's only so much I can do to satisfy some of that, but I definitely recommend it, but it is super dark. As Mara Carlin said, it gets really dark and then it gets so much darker. You're like, wow, I can't believe it went there. So, maybe not the best read for like this present moment, but like, if you are a Hunger Games fan, I definitely recommend it as a better understanding of the overall story.
Fascinating. I will say my appetite for dark right now is approximately zero, but perhaps I'll need a palate cleanse after several seasons of Sophia the First. We'll have to see. I did actually have a couple of lengthy podcasts. I watched listened to Patrick Radden Keefe's new podcast on the Winds of Change, which actually is a pretty great historical primer on CIA involvement in cultural activities of various sorts. So that was pretty interesting. And I started Emily Nussbaum's I Like to Watch, which is her sort of a set of her television columns from The New Yorker, both of which make for pretty good road trip fare if you like cultural commentary of various sorts. So that is a pretty thorough pop culture wrap up, hopefully not too awkward of a transition. And we will be back in a couple of weeks to see where all these incredible stories stand. So good to talk to you, ladies.